This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Are we getting close to a new nuclear deal with Iran? After the United States pulled out of the nuclear deal back in April, that seemed very unlikely. But with the Iranian economy now taking such a hit, and with United States President Donald Trump saying that he's open to the idea of new negotiations, a deal could be on the table once again. The Trumpet's Middle East correspondent, Brent Noctegal, will bring us up to speed on all the latest developments with the Islamic Republic. In the second segment today, we'll talk about King Kennedy. Since so many Supreme Court cases were determined by Justice Anthony Kennedy's swing vote, one analyst said that we should actually change the Pledge of Allegiance to say one nation under Justice Kennedy, indivisible with liberty and justice as he sees fit. He was very powerful, but King Kennedy shocked the country by announcing his retirement just a few weeks ago. But his impact on America remains. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller wrote a powerful article about Kennedy's legacy in the new print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet, and he has some fascinating analysis to share about Kennedy's appointment and tenure and about how it all ties into Bible prophecy. In our third segment today, we're going to go in a different direction and discuss the increasingly powerful security and surveillance capacity of the German government. Trumpet writer Josue Michel will be making his Trumpet Hour debut today to tell us about some alarming trends underway in his home country of Germany. And to wrap up the show today, I want to talk a little about a literary folktale from the 1800s that teaches a lesson that's probably more relevant now than ever before. All of this on today's Trumpet Hour. Well, the Iranian currency is in free fall, and many of the citizens of the country are openly protesting against their government and calling for reforms. And meanwhile, United States President Donald Trump has said, in the right circumstances, he is open to the idea of sitting down with the Iranian leadership for negotiations. Does this mean Iran could be on the brink of a new nuclear deal? Could it mean a new and less antagonistic direction for Iran's foreign policy? And how does this tie in with Bible prophecy? For a report addressing this development and these questions, we now go to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal.
Are we close to another Iran deal? While it seemed extremely unlikely after the election of United States President Donald Trump, and especially after the United States pulled out of the nuclear deal in April, comments from Mr. Trump on Monday have left the door open to a future negotiation. At a press conference with Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte on Monday, Mr. Trump was asked by a reporter if he would be willing to sit down with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and under what conditions. This was his response.
So I believe in meeting. I would certainly meet with Iran if they wanted to meet. I don't know that they're ready yet. They're having a hard time right now.
Do you have preconditions for that meeting?
No preconditions. No. If they want to meet, I'll meet. Anytime they want. Anytime they want. It's good for the country, good for them, good for us, and good for the world. No preconditions. If they want to meet, I'll meet.
And so Mr. Trump is ready to meet with the Iranians anytime, any place, without preconditions. And he said that in the context of the hard time they're going through right now. By a hard time, Mr. Trump was referring to the extreme financial crisis Iran is facing as its currency, the rial, continues to plummet. On January 1st this year, the dollar was worth 42,900 rials, but it's been in free fall, especially in recent days. The rial hit 100,000 to the dollar for the first time on Sunday and continued its decline on Monday, losing 18% of its value in less than 2 days. On Tuesday, the rial reached a fresh record low of 119,000 to the dollar, a loss of nearly two-thirds of its value since the start of the year. The Iranian government has been in crisis mode, replacing its central bank chief last week. The central bank issued a statement on Monday blaming the currency volatility on the enemy's conspiracy and vowed fresh countermeasures in coming days. Now, what's even more worrying for Iranians is that the reimposition of United States sanctions has not even happened yet. The first group of those sanctions start on August 6th, and the full sanctions, including the sanctions on Iranian oil exports, will begin November 4th. And so, the Iranian economy is already in a bad way and is set to get so much worse. The effect could push Iran in one of two ways. It could lead Iran to change its behavior, or it could make Iran even more belligerent, feeling like it's pushed into a corner. Comments between the two, President Rouhani and President Trump, last week seem to indicate that we were on a warpath. America must understand well that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace, Rouhani said in comments directed towards Mr. Trump. Then he said this, war with Iran is the mother of all wars. Mr. Trump, do not play with the lion's tail because you will regret it eternally. Rouhani also doubled down last week on his previous threats to disrupt global shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, saying that Iran has been, quote, the guarantor of the regional waterway security throughout history. His threats were echoed and clarified by a senior Iranian military official who said, quote, the Strait of Hormuz region must either be safe for all or be insecure for everyone. Now, Mr. Trump didn't take too lightly to those comments, responding with a threat of his own via Twitter, where he said this, to Iranian President Rouhani, never ever threaten the United States again or you will suffer the consequences, the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious. Now, those comments were just last week. Now, it seems, the door is open for compromise. His remarks evoked his approach to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, with whom he met in June just 10 months after threatening Pyongyang with, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen. Similarly, Mr. Trump has sought to tighten diplomatic relations with Chinese President Xi Jinping after accusing Beijing of manipulating its currency and, quote, raping our country on trade. But while this process seems to be working with North Korea and possibly China, there is every reason to believe that it will be much harder to bring Iran back from the brink. The demands the Trump administration has presented for any new Iranian nuclear deal would require Iran to cease its support for militant groups in the Middle East and stop enriching all uranium, a stipulation that is stricter than the 2015 Iranian Accord. There might be discussions with Mr. Trump, but barring regime change in Iran, it's hard to see that any amount of pressure from the United States will be able to change the direction of the regime. And by regime, I mean a theocratic dictatorship. While Iran can in some instances appear as a democracy, it's worthwhile to look back quickly at the beginning of the current regime to see if it's possible for them to turn around. In 1979, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini returned to Iran from exile. He and other Islamist clerics declared Iran's monarchy to be extinct. Khomeini and his fellow Shiite revolutionaries were determined to build an empire, but a far different one to the Persian Empire of antiquity. They purged the government and created their own unique regime comprised of fundamentalist Islamic clerics. By their decree, strict religious practices began to be enforced across the nation. Offenders were severely and even violently punished. This absolute rule of the clerics or mullahs, known as Valiyat Fakih, is the foundational principle of post-revolution Iran. At the head of Iran's government is the supreme leader, currently Ali Khamenei. The supreme leader is considered to be the heir of the Prophet Muhammad and the representative of the famed 12th and final imam to come. According to Shia Islam, the supreme leader not only has power over the Iranian regime, but also full and absolute authority over all Muslims. Therefore, Shia Muslims generally recognize no man-made national borders or national governments as being legitimate when it comes to Islamic affairs. Iranian foreign policy advisor Mohammad Javad Zarifzadeh once said about his nation, quote, we have a major place in the world of Islam. There is no country other than Iran that has the ability to lead the Islamic world, end quote. The Iranian Revolution wasn't just a regime change inside Iran, but rather a fundamental transformation of how Iran viewed the Islamic world and the rest of the globe. Islamic leadership belong not to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, or even Turkey, but to the supreme leader in Iran. This lack of political borders creates a lack of traditional constraints that we are unfamiliar with in the West. It means to induce Iran away from its expansionist goals, and its actions in places like Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq is telling Iran to denounce the fundamental belief of the regime. This is unlikely to change, especially as most in the regime believe that a violent war actually hastes the return of their 12th Imam. This fundamental nature of the Iranian regime means that they are unlikely to moderate, even if they do end up sitting down at the table with Mr. Trump. However, there is another reason whereby we know that Mr. Trump's seemingly outstretched hand to Iran will not be successful, and that reason is Bible prophecy. In 1992, when Iran and Iraq were on equal footing, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry forecast that Iran was about to rise up and dominate the Middle East. He said Iran would eventually grow strong enough to aggressively push against the West, specifically against a resurgent Europe. This outcast nation would build a powerful regional bloc on the foundation not of money or oil, technology or arms, but on a unique combination of fervent religion and bloody terrorism. Almost 30 years later, this is the Iran we see today. How did Mr. Flurry and the Trumpet know that radical Islam would become so potent and that Iran would be its warlord dominating the Middle East? The answer came from the Bible. If you'd like to know more about this prophesied rise of Iran and why Iran will not moderate anytime soon, please request Gerald Flurry's free book, The King of the South.
Well, that's some very insightful analysis there, Brent. We really appreciate that. What kind of leverage does the United States really have here, though, especially having, you know, we just saw the Obama administration enter into this historic deal, and then here comes a new president and almost immediately pulls right back out of it. That doesn't seem like it would instill much faith and trust and confidence in the Iranian regime or in anyone else in the world for that matter. You know, every 4 or 8 years, U.S. deals are up for total overhaul. How do you think that factors into the kind of leverage the U.S. would now have trying to, you know, approach Iran once again?
Well, I guess there'd be a couple of things to say on that. I mean, I think the United States is limited as far as its negotiating power just because of they're not dictators in the sense that they can't be in there for life. And so if you're going to accomplish something, it has to be done in a limited amount of time. I would say that if the nuclear deal, if that was put forward as an actual treaty and that it was voted upon by the government, that would have been harder for President Trump to withdraw from it. But the Obama administration chose not to do that because they knew they wouldn't get the votes. But as far as, you know, the power that the United States has to bring Iran to the negotiating table, there is quite a bit. The whole reason that the Iranians were willing to negotiate, even as limited as the nuclear deal was in its scope, was because of the sanctions, the economic sanctions that were put on by the United States that other nations, Russia, China, and others jumped in on. That's why the negotiation happened with the Iranians originally. Now, as that negotiating process continued through the year and a half, 2 years that they were negotiating the nuclear deal, you saw Iran threaten to walk away numerous times. And so the deal got worse and worse and worse for the United States and better and better and better for the Iranians. Now, if we are going to go back to the negotiating table, obviously the Iranians are not hopeful. Well, they wouldn't be hopeful that they would get the same terms as they could get from the Trump administration. But right now, as far as the Iran's economy, it is in a tailspin. I was just watching before the show here, watching some footage out of one of the provinces in Iran where people are taking to the streets boldly marching, saying, get us out of Gaza, get us out of Lebanon. I fight for Iran. but I don't fight for the Iranian regime. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of a huge groundswell of support right now for in anti-regime protests. But it doesn't, at least us, as we look at this, it doesn't seem that they would be strong enough to affect any change. I would say if regime change was possible in Iran, that you could have a serious negotiation with the United States and that the United States would not increase its sanctions. But the sanctions haven't even come on yet. Basically, you've got people, companies throughout Europe, throughout the world, throughout the United States that are saying, well, since U.S. sanctions are coming back, we're getting out of Iran right now. But as far as the sanctions, they don't even start till the middle of August. And then oil sanctions, the big ones, they take place in November. So I believe there is a lot of leverage the United States has. However, the Iranian regime won't even come to the negotiating table because they know they will not get a favorable deal like they would under the Obama administration.
Yeah, well, in your report there and in your article that'll be going up on the website about this, you know, you mentioned that this could either prompt the Iranians to actually effect some kind of reform or make them more belligerent. And of course, it seems like you're leaning toward the latter option there. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I would say that we're not in 2009, 2010 right now. We're in 2018. And the Iranian regime has entrenched itself and only garnered more and more power. And so there's no going back for them. The whole policy there, the policy, the foundational principles of the Islamic revolution that took place there and it's been installed in the past 30 years has dictated that they need to push forward with their quest for dominance, and they will do that. They will continue to do that. They went to the negotiating table before because they believe that they could have both the best of both worlds. They could get money, sanctions removed, and still pursue a belligerent foreign policy, an expansionist foreign policy. And so they are committed to that. They are committed to that. They cannot negotiate with the great Satan over this because they know that they won't get anything out of it. Also, looking at it through the lens of Bible prophecy, we know that Iran is going to be a major player in our time, a major player that has a pushy foreign policy, a major player that is motivating other nations to have to defend themselves. And so that as well, and that's based on a prophecy in Daniel 11 and verse 40. We talk about quite a lot how Iran is this king of the south that is pushing at the king of the north, and notably pushing at other nations even before then as well, given its power that it has across the Middle East when this prophecy takes place, that it shows that we have something akin to this Islamic regime still in power in Iran when this prophecy takes place. And so I would say that's an indication that we are not headed for any type of moderation with the Iranian regime right now. And if Mr. Trump is president, that probably means that they're not going to be even negotiating with him.
And is there any literature that you would recommend to the listeners out there who would like to dig deeper into what is behind Iran's push for dominance and how it aligns with those prophecies that you mentioned there?
Well, the overwhelming evidence of the big booklet that we have on this is The King of the South, and that's requested for free, written by our editor-in-chief, recently updated. And there's also the trend section on the website itself. The trends for the Middle East, if you go to there, we've got three of them, I think, right now. We just finished the fourth writing it, and it's about how Iran leads radical Islam, and it goes into the history of the Iranian regime and shows how it is set up by its very nature to fulfill, in a way, this prophecy of the King of the South. It's not up yet, but it'll be up soon. So I would go right now to read that booklet, The King of the South, and of course they could just read the article that I wrote about this specific event as well.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Iran and what the economic turmoil that the nation is now suffering may mean for its future. Please go to thetrumpet.com to read Brent's powerful article on this topic. We'll have that posted today or in the next few days. We'll also have a link in the show notes to the King of the South booklet that he discussed there and the relevant trends articles that he mentioned. Brent, we really appreciate you keeping us apprised of these developments and just helping us to see the significance of it. So thanks very much for your time.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
If you take a look at the United States today, you see that the nation has been fundamentally transformed, especially over the last 30 years or so. And much of this transformation has been accomplished in large part by Justice Anthony Kennedy. He's now retiring, but he leaves behind an impact on the country that is deep and destructive. To understand this impact and what it means for the United States and how it ties into Bible prophecy, we'll go to this report from trumpet writer Andrew Miller.
The United States is on a dangerous path toward lawlessness. For decades, progressive activists have strived to fundamentally transform American society by emphasizing ends over means. If a progressive policy lacks enough support to be passed by the lawmaking branch of government, then radicals call for the president to enact it via executive order, or for the Supreme Court to enact it via judicial activism, or for demonstrators to take to the streets in protest. This ends-over-means strategy has given birth to a living constitution, a doctrine that says that the U.S. Constitution no longer means what it meant when written. It says America's founding legal charter is an evolving document that can mean whatever progressives need it to mean at any given moment. 31 years ago, the living Constitution doctrine gained great ascendancy in American society. When the Senate refused to confirm Judge Robert Bork to the Supreme Court, President Ronald Reagan nominated Judge Anthony Kennedy to fill the empty seat. Yet instead of interpreting the law as written, Justice Kennedy consulted his own personal feelings on issues and discovered constitutional rights that no one had ever seen before. Kennedy cast the tie-breaking vote in several controversial cases, earning himself a reputation as the most important voter in America and King Kennedy. He played a huge role in liberalizing American society. But yesterday, Justice Anthony Kennedy officially stepped down from the Supreme Court. Some are optimistic that Kennedy's replacement will be able to reverse some of his more lawless decisions, but the societal transformation he enabled will not be easily undone. King Kennedy is gone, but his legacy lives on. To understand this lawless trend, you need to know what happened to America in 1987. On July 1, 1987, President Ronald Reagan nominated Robert Bork, a highly respected judge, to become a Supreme Court justice. Yet within 45 minutes of his nomination, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy became demonizing Bork in a shocking way. Why? Judge Bork was a strong, articulate defender of the Constitution, and Senator Kennedy and his affiliates considered this a ghastly thing. Trump editor-in-chief recounts this vital history in his book, America Under Attack. Senator Ted Kennedy argued that Bork's originalism would lead to a Bork's America of back-alley abortion, segregation, censorship, and midnight police raids. None of these accusations were true, but the attack worked, and Judge Bork never took a seat on the bench. After the Senate defeated Judge Bork's nomination, President Reagan nominated Anthony Kennedy as a compromise candidate, and the Senate confirmed Kennedy by a unanimous vote. In the decades since, the Supreme Court has acted like a legislative body, enacting policies on abortion, affirmative action, and homosexuality that the law-breaking branch of government would not enact themselves. As a swing voter during much of his time on the court, Kennedy contributed to the attack on the Constitution and the trend toward lawlessness that has accelerated since Bork's demonization. In 1992, Kennedy wrote the plurality decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. This case confirmed the Roe versus Wade decision that a woman's right to privacy allows her to murder her unborn child, and helped overturn a requirement that a woman notify her husband before having an abortion. In 2003, Kennedy wrote the majority opinion in Lawrence versus Texas. This case overturned judicial precedent to make homosexual activity legal in every U.S. state and territory, and it struck down anti-sodomy laws in 14 states, declaring consensual sex a protected liberty under the U.S. Constitution. In 2013, Kennedy authored the majority opinion in the United States versus Windsor. This case declared the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional because it permitted states to refuse recognition to same-sex unions conducted in other states. Kennedy wrote that treating heterosexual marriages different from homosexual unions demeaned couples whose sexual choices the Constitution protects. In 2015, Kennedy cast the tie-breaking vote and authored the majority opinion in Obergefell versus Hodges. This landmark case struck down state bans on same-sex marriage, and it ruled that same-sex couples have a right to marry based on the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. In all these cases and others, Kennedy usurped powers that the Constitution grants to Congress, the states, and the people to enact policies on abortion, affirmative action, and homosexuality that he personally supported. So instead of living in Bork's America, we now live in Kennedy's America. The demonization of Robert Bork was only the opening statement of a legal battle on judicial appointments that has lasted over 30 years. The same plaintiffs who demonized Bork tried to Bork constitutional originalist Clarence Thomas in 1991, and more recently, proponents of the living Constitution have tried to Bork Supreme Court nominees Neil Gorsuch, and more recently yet, Brett Kavanaugh. After President Donald Trump nominated Judge Kavanaugh on July 9th to fill Anthony Kennedy's empty seat, opposition activists immediately began denouncing him. They said Kavanaugh threatened environmental rights, homosexual rights, and most especially, abortion rights. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer pledged to block Kavanaugh's confirmation due to a belief that he might roll back abortion rights if he joins the Supreme Court. And other government officials, like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, are calling on the American people to rally around Roe versus Wade and defend a woman's right to kill her unborn child from constitutional originalist. If Americans are this outraged over the possibility of a potential justice possibly beginning to restrict abortions, what will happen if the Supreme Court actually makes such a decision? The tide turned in a big way in 1987, Mr. Fleury writes, in America Under Attack. Law started to get a lot weaker, and lawlessness started to get much, much stronger. Increasingly, people are trampling the Constitution, demonizing those who hold biblical moral values, and rioting when they don't get their way. The Bible reveals that this spirit of lawlessness is leading the nation to a time of anarchy and violent revolution. In Isaiah chapter 1, verses 4 through 5, God says, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backward. Why should you be stricken any more? You will revolt more and more because the whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint." For the past 30 years, lawless Americans have looked to a progressive Supreme Court to trample the rule of law by legislating from the bench. And now that a new president is nominating Supreme Court justices who pledge to uphold the rule of law, these same progressives are calling for violent resistance.
Well, thank you very much for that really insightful report there, Andrew. It really does paint a sobering picture of the state of American society. What are your thoughts about the, or what are the specific techniques that those who, you know, are not in favor of the man who Trump tapped as Kennedy's replacement, what kind of techniques do you expect them to use to try to block his appointment?
Well, we're already seeing a continuation of the point I brought out in the beginning of this segment of the kind of like the ends over means, or the ends justify the means style of blocking judicial nominees. The main thing that you're going to see to try to block some of the judicial nominees like Brett Kavanaugh is just trying to convince people that he's going to overturn Roe versus Wade and roll back abortion rights, which he hasn't actually ruled much on abortion in the past. So he's kind of a wild card in terms of what would actually happen there. But you're definitely seeing like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and other key Democrats even trying to convince Republicans whose constituents want abortions that he's going to roll this back. And so he doesn't need to be confirmed. He needs to be blocked. But if that doesn't work, you're also seeing seeing the continuation of like the whole Russia collusion narrative. Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, made that point. Actually, extra Neil Gorsuch was nominated to the Supreme Court last year. Mm-hmm. That since he says the Russians hacked the U.S. election, Trump's not a real president, and therefore the justices he appoints aren't real justices. And trying to make the point that basically any 5-4 cases where either Kavanaugh or Gorsuch end up as the deciding vote aren't even real cases, because they're appointed by a judge who is appointed by a president who, despite all evidence to the contrary, they say was installed by the Russian government. And so that is just really kind of an example of that, like ends over means, using rumors that have never been collaborated to block someone who legally should have every right to be on the court, because he's not giving you what you want.
Given Justice Kennedy's, you know, political leanings, his cultural, his ideologies and everything like that, the nation was fairly shocked that he would resign during President Trump's presidency. Do you have any thoughts about why he would have done that, knowing that he would most likely be replaced by a very conservative justice?
Well, he is a hard man to predict. Like I mentioned, he's relied much more on his personal feelings than what the law says. Mm-hmm. And some of his personal feelings are conservative and others are liberal, generally. Right. On economic issues, he does vote with the conservatives.
Right.
And then on social issues like homosexuality, he votes with the liberals, and it's hard to tell which of those two sides of his personality he favors more. But it is pretty well known why he resigned, is that he was friends with Judge Andrew Napolitano. Mm-hmm. At Fox News, which according to Napolitano, he told him that he wanted to resign during a Republican presidency. And according to Donald Trump, he called him before he made his announcement and told him that he wanted Trump to pick his successor. So he was going to resign before the midterm elections, so Trump would still have the support in Congress to pick whoever he wanted. Okay. So even though he has just done a very unconstitutional power grab on forcing issues like same-sex marriage that Congress wouldn't approve on 300 million people, just by being virtue of the swing voter, he does still have some conservative principles on economics and wanted Donald Trump to be the one to pick his replacement.
Well, this is a really fascinating topic. We've been speaking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's written an article in our latest print edition called How Anthony Kennedy Corrupted America, and you'll be able to find that on our website hopefully tomorrow or soon after. And we will also have a link in our show notes to America Under Attack, which Andrew mentioned in his report there. So please go to thetrumpet.com and check that out. A very powerful booklet just to understand the transformation that America has been undergoing in recent decades. Andrew, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on this.
And thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Roman poet Juvenal famously wrote, "Quis custodiet ipsos custodes," which translates to "Who will watch the watchers themselves?" And it's a question that more and more people are asking in Germany as the government keeps increasing its security and surveillance capacity. Trumpet writer Josue Michel is making his debut on the Trumpet Hour today to tell us about this trend and how closely it aligns to some specific Bible prophecies.
Since the refugee crisis began, Germany has faced an increased security risk. Over the course of the last 3 years, thousands of women have been sexually assaulted by migrants. Germany even suffered a series of terrorist attacks. In response, Germany's police have drastically upgraded their forces, and they are boosting their surveillance capacities. Many Germans themselves have been frightened by these developments, in some cases even more than by the refugee crisis. So we have to ask, what is happening? In March, Germany's new Interior Minister, Horst Seehofer, promised to increase the nation's police and security forces with additional 7,500 more officers. Furthermore, he promised to expand Germany's video surveillance significantly. Seehofer promised to protect its citizens from the effects of an unprecedented refugee crisis. He claims that Germans have a right to feel safe in their own country. This sounds all fine, but are Germans about to lose their freedom for the sake of their safety? Seehofer's promised increases are only the tip of the iceberg. Germany's security landscape is rapidly changing. In recent years, much has been done so that Germany's security forces are not in bad condition. Already in 2016, the German police invested millions to upgrade their equipment. And it's not just regular equipment. In some cases, the police also ordered material for their special commandos, usually only used by soldiers, such as assault rifles and armed vehicles. But that's not all. The German army is also now training to assist Germany's police forces. Hundreds of German Bundeswehr soldiers are again on German streets. They were banned from those without exception at the end of World War II. This is a drastic change. Together, the German army and police have held various exercises coordinating their cooperation in case of a large-scale terrorist attack. Yet under Seehofer, Germany's security forces are gaining even more power. In his inaugural speech, Seehofer demanded, quote, "zero tolerance for offenders, strict border controls, a limit to immigration, a course of consistent deportation, 7,500 new posts for the police," end quote. That was according to Bild report for March 23rd. Knowing that the new measures would be criticized, Seehofer also said, quote, "safety is not right or left. Safety is not conservative. Security is a human right. A strong state does not tolerate a legal vacuum," end of quote. He also said, quote, "where limits are exceeded, rules violated, or laws broken, I see zero tolerance. There is zero tolerance for me when it comes to hate slogans and violence against differently minded and people of other faith. We must do the best possible for the safety of our citizens," end quote. When he mentions doing the best for the citizens, this includes the expansion of video surveillance. As you may know, Germany is a liberal country. But Seehofer said when it comes to protecting the citizens, we need a strong state. Soon after Seehofer's announcements, Bavarian police forces began to adopt and change their police law. Tens of thousands of German citizens have marched onto Bavarian streets in protest, but their objections have been in vain. They claimed that the expanded police rights in Bavaria show great similarity to those of the Nazi regime. But their claim was rejected by the government. The question is, are the fears of these expanding powers reasonable? Or are they indeed unfounded, as authorities claim? When considering this question, it's important to know that it's not only Bavaria that is changing their police law. More and more states do it to grant their officers more power, including that of surveillance. And some even fear that Bavaria's new and controversial police law could soon serve as the basis for all of Germany. As more and more of the changes are implemented, Germans are starting to ask, who will protect us from our own government? Who will watch the watchers themselves? The Bible has prophesied of the resurrection of Germany's strong state. And the Bible gives answers about where it is leading, alluding to Germany's past and corruption in Germany's security forces today. Our booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, vehemently warns against the rise of Germany's strong state. If you have not read this powerful booklet, please request a free copy and find undeniable proof of the looming danger. But beyond history and prophecy, some Germans themselves are sounding the alarm today. In a column for Spiegel Online, Sascha Lobo warned last February that under Seehofer, Germany would turn into a surveillance state. Lobo referred to Seehofer's role as Super Interior Minister. He gave his article a sarcastic title, Super Safe in a Super Surveillance State. In one section, Lobo wrote, quote, most of all, one can expect more surveillance from a Christian social Super Interior Minister. For example, with intelligent super video surveillance. One aspect of German society that Seehofer is most eager to defend is its Christian heritage. In 2017, reports indicate that nearly 100 anti-Christian crimes were committed between January and the end of November alone. Attacks on churches and Christian symbols accounted for a quarter of these crimes. The German government has expressed shock over crimes and is determined to bring an end to them. On March 16th, Seehofer said in an interview with Bild, quote, Islam does not belong to Germany. Germany is shaped by Christianity. That includes the Sunday rest, religious holidays and rituals such as Easter, Pentecost and Christmas. Of course, the Muslims living with us belong to Germany, but of course, that does not mean that we give our country's specific traditions and customs up out of false consideration. End quote. Bavarian Interior Minister Joachim Herrmann agrees with Seehofer's logic. He said, quote, anyone who wants to live here must distance themselves from any anti-Christian disposition. Otherwise, they are simply not welcome. End of quote. Interestingly, such strong words have not been used against the over 1,000 anti-Muslim crimes committed in 2017, the same year. Germans' desire for security and protection against radical Islam is certainly understandable, and many of these statements sound reasonable. But the Bible reveals that the nation will become more and more zealous about its religious roots. This zeal will lead into a disturbing future of widespread violence and destruction in Germany and beyond. Germany's emerging resistance against immigration and open promotion of its Catholic and Protestant heritage is exactly what you would expect after reading Bible prophecies. Revelation 13 prophesies that the near future of Germany holds a state-enforced religion that tolerates no other form of worship. That is especially clear in verse 15. Then verse 17 describes the mark of the beast. This mysterious sounding mark is something without which individuals can no longer buy or sell. This mark is enforced by the government to protect the country's culture and religion. Many in the past have speculated what this mark is, but its meaning is revealed in the pages of your own Bible. In his booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast?, Herbert W. Armstrong explained the mark of the beast is actually Sunday rest. This is a doctrine created by the Catholic Church and is one of the many symbols of the Holy Roman Empire. Sunday rest is already an official law in Germany and in the European Union, but it has not yet been enforced. But Berlin is building up its strength, as it has done before with terrible consequences. Germany is quickly expanding its surveillance capacities and strengthening its security apparatus. Soon it will be able to enforce that mark. Please order a copy of Who or What is the Prophetic Beast to understand the vital truth about his mark, about so much of what is happening in Europe. Bible prophecy also shows that radical Islam led by Iran will motivate the Germans to resurrect their strong authoritative government. Daniel 11 verse 40, for example, describes a German-led Europe destroying Iran and radical Islam. The verse reveals that prior to this destruction, radical Islam will have been pushing Germany. To learn about the Bible's forecast of a violent clash of religions in which Islam and Iran war against Catholicism and Germany, order your free copy of The King of the Thaws by Gerald Fluey.
Well, thanks very much for that really sobering report there, Josue. We really appreciate that. You mentioned a little bit about the German army being back on the street in kind of a policing capacity. Could you talk a little bit about the history of why that, you know, being reintroduced, why that's so significant?
Sure. Many other European countries, they use their army to protect their people, especially in cases of terrorist attacks. But in Germany, the army has been banned from German streets due to its history in World War II. In World War II, the German army was actually used against the German people to control them, to stop protestings and other means of suppression. But in recent years after World War II, the German constitution, called the Basic Law, has been changed only slightly, which allows the German army to be involved in Germany again, but only under catastrophic measures, as it says.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Josue. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michel, who has written an article about this trend in his home country. The article is called German Government Increases Security Surveillance Powers. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Josue, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you for coming in.
It's time for today's last word.
Well, like many of you listeners, when I was young, I read a story called The Emperor's New Clothes. It's a very well-known literary folktale by Hans Christian Andersen, the Danish author. It was written back in the 1800s. And lately, I've been thinking more about this short story. And I even reread it recently, just because I think that in the modern social climate of the Western world, the lesson that it teaches is probably more relevant than ever. And it also reinforces some timeless wisdom from the Bible. So the basic plot of the story, if it's been a while since you've heard it, is that there is a really vain and materialistic emperor who is obsessed with high fashion. He loves wearing chic new clothes. And he decides to hire a couple of weavers who promise to make him the finest set of clothes that money can buy. These two weavers are actually con men, but they decide to just try to make some money by tapping into something that exists in great abundance wherever human beings live, and that is intellectual vanity. So the two con men say that they're making the most luxurious, breathtakingly beautiful set of clothes imaginable, but they explain that they're making it with a type of fabric that's invisible to anyone who is either unfit for his position or hopelessly stupid. In reality, of course, these old cons are not making any clothes at all. They pretend to be weaving some, but there's no thread on the looms, so they're basically just miming the whole process for several days. But since none of the emperor's noblemen want to appear stupid or unfit for their position, each of them pretends to see the clothes. They all fear that they may be the only one who can't see them, so their vanity compels them to pretend that they do. And of course, the emperor does the same thing. And he ends up being paraded out into the streets wearing nothing at all. The townsfolk kind of, you know, uncomfortably go along with the charade because no one wants to be exposed as being stupid. But finally, a little child who is too young to understand the social risks of not maintaining this pretense, this little child just kind of blurts out that the emperor is not wearing any clothes. And then others among the townsfolk admit that the child's right. The emperor himself, though, realizes that the child probably is right, but he still decides that the show must go on. So he just starts walking and strutting more proudly than ever. So anyway, it's a story that most of us probably know pretty well, but I think it takes on new meaning in a way if we look at some of the social shifts in the Western world that are suddenly not just fashionable to endorse, but actually dangerous not to endorse. Even 20 or 25 years ago, a person could say that they believe in a traditional view of marriage and family and even basic biology, and that would be acceptable to almost everyone. But today, especially in the halls of academia, where the people see themselves as especially enlightened, there's no quicker way to be labeled as blind, backward, and imbecilic than to defend a traditional framework for those kinds of things. There is great pressure on people to conform to the new leftist orthodoxy. You know, if you don't see it our way, then something's wrong with you. You are unfit for your position or hopelessly stupid. And of course, there's more to it than just intellectual vanity, but that is a part of the reason why there's more and more of what you might call intellectual tyranny in most Western universities today, and in mainstream media, and you even see more and more of it taking root in broader society. Mr. Joel Hilliker, the usual host for the show, has written about this in his powerful booklet, Redefining Family. One short quote from that says, "The great majority are forming views, making decisions, and creating policies, having been influenced, even bullied, by political correctness, peer pressure, or societal coercion. There has been a clandestine yet concerted effort to radically change people's minds, and whether they realize it or not, many people have come to accept and embrace this idea because they've been unwittingly manipulated to do so." End quote. I also think it's interesting in the Hans Christian Andersen story that the only one who is willing to risk looking stupid by speaking his conscience was a child. You know, the Bible does say that people striving to follow Christ need to be childlike. Mark chapter 9, for example, records a time when Jesus Christ was speaking with his disciples, and he was trying to teach them about the importance of being meek and humble. And he called a small child over and picked him up and basically told the disciples they needed to become as humble and meek as that child if they wanted to be successful in their spiritual lives. And then there are also several Bible passages that caution against the kind of intellectual vanity that's exposed by this story. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and also chapter 8 talk about that. And then Romans 1 discusses people who profess to be wise but are actually the opposite. And this old story illustrates that tendency of human nature in what I think is a really powerful way. And I believe that's why the story remains relevant today and even takes on some new depth and relevance. We'll be sure to have a link in our show notes to Mr. Hilliker's booklet, Redefining Family. And if you've not read that, I really hope you'll order a copy and give it a careful read because it can help you to understand the dangerous cultural shifts that are underway in the Western world in a powerful way. I'm Jeremiah Jacques. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Thank you for listening today. Feel free to send us your thoughts and questions about the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I'd like to thank our guests today, Brent Noctegal, Andrew Miller, and Josue Michel. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with this thought from Elie Wiesel. There is divine beauty in learning. To learn means to accept the postulate that life did not begin at my birth. Others have been here before me, and I walk in their footsteps. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.